Sexually transmitted diseases have been hidden players in our lives for the whole of human history, with roles in everything from World War II to the growth of the internet to, yes, The Bachelor. But despite their prominence, STDs have been shrouded in mystery and taboo for centuries, which begs the question, why do we know so little about them? Enter Dr. Ina Park, who has been pushing boundaries to empower and inform others about sexual health for decades. With her new book, Strange Bedfellows, she ventures far beyond the bedroom to examine the hidden role and influence of these widely misunderstood infections and share their untold stories. Dr. Ina Park is an associate professor at the University of California San Francisco School of Medicine and medical consultant at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Division of STD Prevention. Her new book is Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. And we welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Dr. Ina Park, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Well, very nice. You know, this book is fascinating. How long has this been a part of your life in dealing with the subject?
So I actually started in college as a peer educator over at UC Berkeley, and I tell that story in the book where I dress up as a giant condom and end up doing a condom demonstration. And this is what got me to medical school, actually, believe it or not. And
we'll have to start someplace.
Or at least I think it did. And then, so sexual health has always been an interest of mine, but I would say that, you know, I've been working professionally in the field since about 2007. And, you know, I was just seeing STD rates getting worse and feeling like there was still so much stigma attached to these infections that I wanted to write a book that might be able to use storytelling and humor to tell the, you know, the stories behind the science as well as some of the history of these really common infections, and hopefully do it in a way that would draw people in instead of, you know, making people afraid and pushing people away.
You know, STDs have long been a part of my life, and let me explain that. My dad was an epidemiologist. He was a venereal disease control officer in his early years, working around various cities and part of the country to try to find outbreaks of sexually transmitted diseases, and then eventually worked with and was a federal government employee for years working on this issue of venereal disease and now known better as STDs. And, you know, these are the things that I woke up with or that I grew up with, where I would open up the refrigerator and my father would say, yeah, there's some blood vials to the left of the orange juice. Don't touch those.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, good times. So one of the stories that he told me, he's passed, but one of the stories that I grew up hearing is that many times he would be booked on television shows. This is, let's say, mid to late 1960s, early 1970s. He'd be booked on TV shows, and they would say, oh, you know, tell the world what you do. And he would start to explain it. And then when they realized what it was that he did, then he was quickly ushered off the set. And this happened all the time. So I'm curious, when you talk about these stigmas, these have obviously been around a long time, but what was our problem even then, even now, of having the conversation, the kind of conversation that you and I are having this morning?
I mean, I think what it comes down to is that it's just easier to have sex than to actually talk about it.
Yeah.
And especially these sort of least intended consequences, right? When you get into a sexual relationship with somebody, the last thing you are thinking is, you know, this person's going to give me an STI or an STD. And, you know, the thing is a couple weeks ago, CDC released some new estimates that one in five of us right now is walking around with an STI. And so the point is that, you know, we've never really gotten comfortable with it, because when we come up, you know, in our, you know, education through for middle school sex education and high school, most of what we're taught is sort of fear-based. And so naturally, you know, we become a little bit uncomfortable or fearful of these infections, and so we don't want to talk about it because it's something that we don't want to happen to us, and we haven't been taught that this is something that happens to every sexually active person, basically, and we haven't really had a lot of practice in having those conversations, and so that's why I think it's still so difficult.
So when you started in this work, was it still, have you seen the needle move at all? Or is it still as difficult to have these conversations and get eyebrows raised when you come in and say, okay, this is what I want to do today?
Right. You mean have eyebrows raised if I have that conversation, like, for example, with a patient or, you know, if I
yeah,
have that
conversation? Yeah, or even if you, well, I mean, we could even bring this to, you know, how the book's received. I mean, in the sense of, yeah. Oh, by the way, today we're going to talk about sexually transmitted diseases. Is that still a somewhat taboo subject?
I feel like it is, and that is why I wrote this book. So, you know, one of the things is I had been in the field for almost 10 years at the time I decided to write the book, and it's because I have not seen the needle move enough that I felt like I wanted to try a different tactic, you know, by using humor and hopefully disarming people and fascinating them by the topic to see if I could draw people in to talk about it. So I have to say that, you know, what I've heard in terms of reviews and then other readers reaching out to me is that it has been well received, but whether or not we can have a larger sort of national conversation about that, I'm not sure. But that's why I'm here, trying to get people excited about STIs or STDs.
So, and it's interesting because, and you talk about this early in the book, but like with the introduction of Viagra and the ads that came in response to that, I mean, that brought it into our living room, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And and not STDs, but certainly sex. And but did that but they didn't. It was sort of everything was implied, right? Everything was implied as opposed to, I remember that Cialis commercial where they have the two bathtubs, and I thought, well, you know, maybe the problem is they're not in the same tub.
Right.
But
exactly.
I don't know. But is that? But it's subtle, yes.
Yes, it's very subtle, and I think that's part of the issue is that we need to be a little bit more direct about it. And I would love if there's some new treatment for STIs that becomes available. Knowing how common they are, Joe, I would love for people to, I would love for pharmaceutical companies to tout them and promote them as much as, you know, Viagra was touted. And I don't know if that will happen, but I think we have to be more direct about this topic or else we'll never create any support around it. I mean, we have become much more direct with topics such as cancer, for example, that we couldn't talk about that were taboo in the past. And now are much less taboo. So unless we start talking about sex directly, I don't know that we're going to be able to move the needle on this.
And it's still tough to even get a condom ad on the air.
I know, it's true. I mean, that I feel like is getting better because of the, you know, explosion of social media. I mean, I see lots of condom and sex-related content now that can be spread, you know, much more rapidly that way, as opposed to on network television where I think people would be hesitant, for example, to show a condom commercial during the Super Bowl or something like that.
Which would probably help, right? That would probably not only be a good demographic audience, but would help the cause, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There is no doubt. And let me tell you, we know what people do at Super Bowl parties. They drink and then, you know, sex happens afterwards. So I think that would be a fantastic audience to show a condom commercial to.
Let me ask you about, again, you know, going back to how I was raised. But, you know, prior to, so you sort of have, when you think of sexually transmitted disease, you think of sort of before and after, well, not after, but before AIDS and then
yeah.
with AIDS coming onto the scene and being so devastating. Talk a little bit about that, of how HIV AIDS changed the discussion over sexually transmitted disease.
Well, I think for the first time in the 80s, when people realized that a sexually transmitted infection, you know, which had no cure and actually no test for quite some time, you know, could actually kill people, and that really drastically changed folks' sexual behavior, so that people did reduce partners, there was more condom use going on, and, you know, as you know, an entire generation of, you know, especially gay men who were hit very hard, was wiped out by this infection. And so we saw a near disappearance of syphilis in 1999 and 2000. There was actually talk in the U.S. of having a syphilis elimination campaign by the CDC. And then I think what happened was that luckily we developed treatments for HIV that are highly effective. And now if you suppress the virus, you can become undetectable, and therefore you are basically unable to transmit the virus as well. So people are living longer, people are less afraid of sex, and this is a great thing. But in terms of STIs, it is, I think, driving somewhat the growth in STI rates, as well as, you know, things like dating apps, because it's a lot easier to find a partner to have sex online these days. And then there's also, which I write about in my book, a pre-exposure prophylaxis medication, sort of like a birth control pill to prevent HIV. And so I think the combination of those three forces is, you know, leading us to have more unprotected sex and therefore have more STIs or STDs.
You have a chapter in the book, The Garden of Good and Evil, exploring the wonders of the vaginal microbiome. you start by the little helper that you're the first, your name, Ina, rhymes with vagina. So let us talk for a moment about even this of what you look at in this book of the science and what we know, and really even still what is mysterious to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things I talk about in that chapter is, here's one mystery, you know, why, when we know, and we've known for years, that all of these products with chemicals and perfumes that are sold, you know, on the market today for women to cover up whatever vaginal odor they think they might have, we know that they're harmful, and yet we still have, you know, I'm sure a multi-million dollar industry of products. So that's a mystery for why that's around. And then the other thing is that why do some people have such a difficult time where with every change in their hormones, with their menstrual cycle, or every time they have sex, you know, they end up with a imbalance of bacteria in their vagina. And some, I say this, you know, some vaginas are very resilient to changes in hormones and changes in, you know, state, and some are very delicate, and any little thing tips them over into, you know, having an overgrowth of bacteria. So it's a, you know, there's so many mysteries that we have left to unravel, and also we don't even know all of the species of bacteria that are in the vagina. We've characterized a lot of them, but there's still a lot more work to do. I think I'll have job security for a while.
No, I think you do too. Absolutely. You write in the book, and by the way, we should have warned earlier, but if you're listening to us and you you have children and you don't want them to hear this conversation until you've had other discussions with them, well, please,
right.
Do that. We'll be back with you in about 10 minutes. But in the meantime, let me read this. Which you write, although scientists and clinicians have finally aligned themselves on the dangers of douching, the feminine hygiene industry continues in their game of whack-a-mole. Tell me what that means.
Well, you know, if you just walk into your local drugstore, you will see any number of products, you know, including not only just douches, but there are wipes, there are sprays, there are all kinds of products. And the truth is, and one thing I say, which I did not make up, but one thing we say in our field is that the vagina is a self-cleaning oven. So you don't need to put anything in there. And, you know, if folks notice some sort of something is off, things don't smell right, I don't feel right, then that's a reason to go in to see your clinician, not to go buy a product and put chemicals, you know, into the vagina. And so I say, if you read the product label and you say, this is not something that I would put in my mouth, then don't put it in your vagina.
You write in another chapter, I told the story about my father, but my dad was a sex detective, one of those people that went and found other people who had venereal disease. You talk about this in the book, and it is fascinating because we hear a lot, of course, now about contact tracing, but that's what these men and women did. They went throughout cities to find out who was responsible for the venereal disease and the outbreaks in various communities and try to get them under control.
Absolutely. And I think it's wonderful that your dad was a contact tracer. I mean, this makes this conversation that much more fun. But, you know, and you probably, I don't know if you remember this, but, you know, there were no cell phones back then. So some of the contact tracers, one of whom I interviewed for this book, named John Potterat, they'd have to give out the home number to folks, you know, and when they're trying to find the sexual contacting, they might give their phone number out to a sex worker and, you know, just have sex workers calling the house and having the kids answering the phone. So that's just sort of how it went back then. And people kept their, you know, sexual contacts in a little black address book, you know, the little black book. You know, people didn't have smartphones to keep that information. So the way contact tracing was done back then is really different than how it's done now, where everybody is online, and a lot of people are meeting partners online.
Yeah.
And so the way you find people is through social media and also, you know, through different apps, whereas before, you know, you would just go hang out at the local bar or the nightclub or a burger joint where you knew that there were, you know, where folks with STIs might be hanging out, and you would, you know, try to find people that way by, like, actually knocking on doors and going into restaurants and businesses and that kind of thing. So that kind of stuff still happens, but a lot of contact tracing has to be done online now because of the way people meet each other.
It was fascinating. I'm glad we're using the term sex worker now, because I remember in my childhood, you're absolutely right. They all had my dad's phone number, and it became known in our house as the hooker hotline.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's what, you know, that's what John Potterett said. He said, I had the pimps calling the house and, you know, the kids answering the phone and the wife answering the phone. Yep. And he said, and that was just normalized in his house. And he said, the kids are not traumatized and they're doing okay. And it sounds like you're doing okay as well.
Well, yeah, I think I'm doing okay. I don't know about the not traumatized part, but, you know, the not about that. You're right. But about other things. Every once in a while, it'd be funny because, I'd say, well, I'm going to go over to Steve's house, and my dad would say, yeah, maybe stay away from his dad. And you're like, oh, okay. But you, when you think about this online aspect to it, it would seem to me that makes the job that much harder, though, doesn't it? And it would also indicate that you would hope that since that time, that because we have technology, that the message would be easier to get out, and yet because of this oppression, really, it often doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, though, that I have to congratulate some of the dating apps because they are putting prevention messages on their app. They are putting links to get STD testing or HIV testing. So I think that there is a, you know, potential to leverage the enormous reach of these platforms to be able to spread prevention messages. But you're right. I mean, part of the thing about the apps is that you can be somewhat anonymous, or you can actually just have a handle and not actually have, you know, your full name. So you could just, you know, I could just be like at, you know, at San Francisco Girl or whatever. And so if the contact tracer is looking for me and the person who I might have been with sexually doesn't actually remember my name and only knows the handle on my app, but they blocked me, you know, you might have a really hard time as a contact tracer actually finding out who that person was. And so sometimes, you know, not actually having people's identities and phone numbers, which is how people, yeah, you know, used to record their partner's information, is a real hindrance to folks that are trying to do contact tracing after the fact.
So for the folks who are listening to us, how do you, in the book, you, I mean, the stories that you tell, and I love that you use the word in the subtitle adventures, because that's really, these are adventures. It's quite a journey that you take us. I know. So let us talk about how people can take information from this book to lead a safer sexual life.
So one thing that I say, I mean, I am a huge fan of barriers, such as like the internal condom, which we used to call the female condom, as well as the traditional sort of external condom or male condom. And I have to say that unfortunately for STIs, that is the best protection that we have. And so, you know, I have a no judgment policy in terms of if you don't like them, if you have a hard time with them, I completely understand that. But in terms of if you want to avoid an STI or at least reduce your risk, that's really all we have right now. We do have a, you know, a pill that can be taken daily to prevent HIV, but we don't have that kind of, you know, magic pill for STIs yet. And we don't have a laser gun that just blasts all STIs out of the universe. So what we have is, you know, the condom. And so that's what we need to do and encourage use of barriers if you want to prevent STIs. But to a certain extent, I want people to understand that even folks who use condoms 100% of the time can still be at risk for an STI. So part of what I'm trying to say is that we are living with these infections and that they are a natural consequence of being a sexually active person. And so all we can do is try to protect ourselves, and getting tested is so important. We've learned that from COVID-19. People are used to getting, you know, going and getting tests. And so I want people to get in the habit of getting their STI tests as well, you know, at least once a year if you're under 25.
One of the things that you write about in the book that I think is fascinating and really important, and I don't want to forget it in our conversation, but that is that we have this blanket label of STDs and STI, but they are certainly not all created equal.
Oh, you're saying, yes, absolutely.
Of each disease, yes. Well, I mean, meaning within that umbrella of STDs, of those infections, they are very different and they are very scary.
You know, they are really different. And you bring up an interesting point because we're mentioning the words STD and STI. And so when we talk about STIs, there's about, you know, 36 different infections that can be sexually transmitted. And most of them, especially I'll take HPV or human papillomavirus, basically every sexually active person is going to get that, but 90% of us are going to get rid of it and not even realize that we had it. So those are sort of, you know, I would say, you know, not as concerning because they're just STIs that are going to come and go and go away. But if you have that STI persist, it can actually develop into an actual disease. And the case of HPV can actually develop into cancer, which obviously none of us want. So, you know, the other infections such as gonorrhea and chlamydia can also be silent infections, but especially in women, they can lead to complications like infertility and pelvic inflammatory disease and ectopic pregnancy, which, as you know, can be fatal. So not to scare folks into, you know, stopping having sex, but I just want to be, you know, realistic about the fact that these can be serious infections with serious consequences.
And if someone suspects that they have an infection, step one should be what? Because it seems like it's often just, well, we'll hope it goes away.
Absolutely. And I would say that if you are having symptoms, to go and seek care earlier rather than later, because the earlier you nip it in the bud, especially, you know, for both, for people of all genders, but particularly for women, the earlier you nip it in the bud, the less chance you're going to have of having any type of scarring or any, you know, type of complication afterwards. And we do that a lot. You know, denial is very powerful, and we say, you know, if I just ignore it, maybe it'll just go away. And in this case, especially if you're having a symptom, your body is telling you that it's time to do something about it.
I ask this as a serious question, but in this time of coronas, have the number of STDs gone down in our country?
They have. And, you know, the interesting thing is that during shelter in place, the second quarter, at least the preliminary data, the final data are not out yet, but during the second quarter of 2020, we saw a huge decline in STIs. And I think part of it was that people were, you know, based on a few studies that I've seen, people were having less sex. But I'll tell you, you know, I work in an STI clinic, and people can only handle the pandemic-induced sexual repression for so long. And I have to say, I think people are going to start to have sex again. I already see it.
I think you're right, doctor. People will start having sex again.
People will. And I don't. So they're not going to go away. And in fact, in, you know, some parts of the country, things like gonorrhea and syphilis are just as bad as they were pre-pandemic. So, I mean, I think the thing is that we did have a temporary decline because of shelter in place, and 2/3 of the STI clinics in the United States actually either had to close their doors or reduce their services. So that's another factor leading to the decline. We had a testing shortage also at the end of 2020 of STI testing. So yes, of course there were less, but I'm telling you, they're not gone. They're just waiting. They're coming back.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for joining us this morning. The book is about infections and viruses and how they are spread, but it is a very entertaining volume as well. You have taken on the subject beautifully, and it's a very interesting, informative, and fascinating read. Strange Bedfellows is the name of the book, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. It is published by Flatiron Books. Dr. Ina Park, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Strange Bedfellows, Adventures in the Science, History, and Surprising Secrets of STDs. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.